Alan, you're number two at Toyota in England. A massive, massive, massive achievement. Huge company. But you started off your life, your working career in Belfast Zoo. So talk to me about that. What was that job like?
Yes, that was a summer job I had up in Belfast Zoo. Long gone, Belfast. Well, it was actually Belfast Zoo Amusements.
Oh,
so it's the amusements. So it's up in the where the big massive car park is these days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There used to be a big amusement fairground.
I had no idea. There,
long before your time. So no, I got a summer job up there. I think it was about 16.
Wow.
When I did it. So I started off in the. When the little children's rides, just the ones that go round and round. I say, you're collecting the money, using the lever, off you go, you know. It got a bit boring after
Yeah, I'm sure actually. It does. I mean, you look at the guys now, even in Picky Park or whatever they've called Barry's now, and it's just kind of like, pull the lever, you know what I mean?
But then after a number of weeks, I graduated to the Dodgems.
Oh, come on.
But that was the job. That was the job, because you're hanging off the back, collecting the cash, chatting up the girls. You know, that was the job to have. Absolutely brilliant.
100%.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, were you sociable as a teen? Like, did that job bring you out of your shell, or did it add fuel?
No,
did
I think
fire?
It added a bit of rocket fuel.
Do you know
the film That'll Be the Day?
No, tell me.
Well, That'll Be the Day is a film. I think it was released in the 70s. David Essex, Ringo Starr.
Ooh.
And they were on a fairground. That's what we thought we were.
And that just encapsulated while you were
That's
feeling
what
and what you were like.
Yeah. No, it was an absolutely fantastic summer job. I say it brings you out of your shell.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely
Class.
Brilliant.
This episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where we interview an interesting person from Northern Ireland who's living and/or working overseas. Now, who are NI Connections? They are the diaspora department of InvestNI, and their mission is really, really simple. It's to connect the Northern Irish community all around the world. They put together some really incredible resources, including how to move you and your family back home if you haven't lived overseas, how to move to Northern Ireland for the first time, and even how to move your business or open up a new branch in this wonderful place that we call home. You'll also can find hundreds of interviews and profiles with fascinating people who are proud to call this place home, and you can check out all of these things and sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com. Thanks very much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of today's episode.
And so, you know, you grew up in Belfast. Like, what was your childhood like? What sort of things did you get up to?
I had a good childhood, actually. What did I get up to? Bit of music. I've always had music influence in my life. When I was at primary school, I learnt the trombone.
You're looking at a baritone player here,
really?
So there's a fraternity here.
So I learned the trombone, and that was good because I learned music. I learned how to read music. And after primary school, there wasn't a orchestra in the high school. So I joined White House Silver Band, played in the band. We did like concerts in Ulster Hall once. I remember doing something in the Ulster Hall. We did like parks and, you know, this type of thing.
Yeah.
And I did that till I think I was 14. Then I broke my arm. I broke my arm really badly, actually.
How'd you do it?
That's another story. How did I break my arm? It was in the boys' brigade.
Okay,
right. We were practicing on the gymnastics. And you know, you jump on the trampoline and you go over the horse and you're meant to, nice hands on the horse.
Sure.
And off you go over the other side and do a nice landing. Well, that was me. I went off, hit the trampoline that hard. I flew over the horse and landed smack in my arm.
Yuch.
My arm actually doubled back. It was that bad a break. Yeah, it was that bad a
Something
break.
Something out of the exorcism.
Anyway, no lasting injuries.
Brutal.
But because my arm was in cast for like a couple of months.
Bye-bye trombone.
That was a trombone come. And then obviously I was in my early teens. So going out, you know, partying, everything else took over.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, in an alternative reality, you could have been this unbelievable trombone player. So it's funny how like,
turns out. But talking about music, again, music's had a big influence. And talking about films again, actually, that I would say that was, 1979, Quadrophenia came out.
Mm-hmm.
Quadrophenia. And that was the big influence on sort of the me and the people who grew up in our area. So it was all about the Who, the Jam, you know, and you know, all the mod scene was the thing that we did in Belfast in those days. It was a really great time to grow up.
Actually. And were you a mod?
Yes.
That's class.
Semi-model. I didn't have a scooter or anything like that. We still hung out with them, yeah.
I remember seeing clips recently. I don't know who it was. They put up old archival interviews with like mods of Belfast, like, and it was just unbelievable.
But that's what we used to do. We used to go to places like
that. One of you were in one. Were you ever interviewed?
I don't know. I can't remember. That's we used to so go to places like there was the Delta. I don't know if it's still there. We used to go to the Plaza. We used to go to the Midlands Hotel on York Street. Those were the places we used to hang out, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, where were the cinemas? Like, what cinemas would you have gone to?
Oh, I don't remember what cinemas at all, actually. Maybe they went, there was one along the Shore Road. I can't remember what it was called now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember watching James Bond there once, you know, and Unreal. That type of thing, yeah.
The classic cars, eh?
Yeah.
Were you into cars?
I wouldn't say I was massively into cars. I do remember the first car I ever had. It was called a Datsun. I don't know if you know what Datsun is. Datsun's now Nissan. It's long gone.
Okay.
It was a Datsun 120i, this gold-coloured coupe. Actually, it was a really smart looking thing.
But
when I bought it, it was probably 20 years old when I bought it.
Mm.
And the last time I had it was we went to Donegal with my mates with a crate of beer in the back, a couple of crates of beer, and the suspension went completely.
Oh man.
And the car. We remember driving back in the middle of the night with the two wheels, you know, absolutely gone. And yeah, that was my first ever car.
Class.
Actually, yeah.
And so you end up making seatbelts?
So what I did, I went to university in Ulster University, and I did a business degree. And the one thing that appealed to me about going to Ulster University, the business course, was because there was 1 year out in industry. At that time, I hadn't got a clue what I wanted to do.
Sure, man.
So the year came up to go out in the industry, applied to different various places, and I ended up at Fisher Body. Not sure why. I think I liked to go for production. Production management was, I think I had an inkling on that. Didn't know much about it. Went into Fisher Body. I did some work in the production planning area, planning production. But that really hooked me in terms of, this was mass production, because Fisher Body, it's unfortunately, it's long gone now. I think it's about 20 years ago, it closed down. They were making thousands of seatbelts every day. I then went up to the, I think it was called the materials department, and these were the people who were dealing with the customers. And I was talking on the phone to plants in the US like Flint, Michigan, or Buick City, or Lansing Assembly Plant, and that got me hooked. This was big international business, you know, global business, and that's what got me hooked. I think that was got me hooked in the car industry.
Mm.
That was it, and that set me on the path. So then I went back to my final year at university, and then I took a production module, studying more about production,
And then the rocket ship took off from there.
It took off from there, yeah. So when I finished university, I did apply for a number of jobs in Northern Ireland, but in 1988, there wasn't a lot going on. There wasn't big business, but I think by that stage I was hooked on, I want to work on a big global company. Not sure which one, big global company. So I did apply for several big car manufacturers in England, basically England. And then I was, I stayed in the, because in those days, going back to Fisher Body, they were part of General Motors, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They were a subsidiary of General Motors. So actually, I ended up going to Vauxhall, Ellesmere Port, just the other side of the world from Liverpool. And there's the part of General Motors in those days. So, yeah, I started in Vauxhall Motors.
See, when you were in the materials department on the phone to Buick, Michigan and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
What was it about chatting to those guys that revved you up?
I don't think I'd ever spoken to an American before. I'd never been out of the UK, I don't think, until I was 18, you know. So this was just amazing. People out of films, you know, the American accent, you know. Especially that Detroit, you know,
that
accent,
that Rust
Belt
sort of area.
Oh, yeah, it's sort of.
It's crazy. And the desire to be a part of like a big company, like where does that come from? Is it the opportunity?
I think it's just the opportunity for that global presence, the opportunity to travel, which I've had absolutely fantastic travel opportunities in my time, mainly with Toyota. But just that big business, you know, global business. Yeah. That's what got me hooked.
It's your passport to the world. Well, it's certainly been your passport,
definitely,
hasn't it?
Yeah.
So Toyota, talk to me. How'd you end up there?
So I did. I did about 3 years at Vauxhall. Some great jobs. I started purchasing. Then I did another like production planning type job. I ended up as a foreman on the chassis line, supervising 44 quick-witted scousers. That was tough. It was a baptism of fire in terms of my career. But that really taught me about leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened was the plant manager at Vauxhall, a guy called Alan Jones, fantastic guy, later to become Sir Alan Jones for his contribution to the motor industry. He actually left Vauxhall as our plant manager to set up Toyota. He was the first man.
Did he really?
So I sort of knew what was going on at Toyota.
Right.
So when I started, in those days, there was no internet. It was like jobs appeared in the Telegraph on a Thursday. So when I seen the Toyota advertising, I thought, that's for me.
Mm.
That's the one for me. So I put my application in. And I started in Toyota in May 1991 as a production control specialist. Yeah.
And in terms of where you are today, the actual site, I've heard you say before, like a greenfield site or a brownfield site.
It's a greenfield site.
What does that mean?
Greenfield site means you're starting from scratch.
So you're there before the factory even starts being thrown up, basically.
During construction. Construction has started. Now, it was, when I say greenfield, it was an old airfield.
Second World War airfield.
It's a greenfield. You're starting from completely afresh. So I remember when we first started, you'd go up and you'd visit the factory and, you know, it was a construction site. So I watched it. I watched it being built.
Crazy.
From the very
start. So you not only had the chance to be a part of this massive, you know, multinational company, opening up shop, but you had a front row seat to them actually doing it.
Yeah. But remember, it's not just the physical side. The physical side's one thing,
mm-hmm.
and we're always continuing to build physically, but it's setting the company up. Toyota UK. You're not just bringing Toyota from Japan. You're setting up as UK. How are we going to operate in the UK? What are the business practices? What are our human resources policies? Everything, we got to adapt to the UK. That's the more challenging side rather than building the factory.
Bit different to operating the merry-go-round.
Yes. There's a few merry-go-rounds in there too, actually.
Bit of doldrums too, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Class.
Every day.
So, I mean, I only knew this because, you know, as we were talking about off-air, I interviewed this incredible local entrepreneur called Ryan Tierney.
Yes.
How long ago was that, Daniel? Is that over 6 months, 8 months?
It was last summer.
Yeah, so, I mean, only recently, really. And I'd never heard anything about Toyota before. Toyota was just a badge on a car for me. It meant nothing to me. I had no idea about the Japanese origin. I had no idea about the family. I had no idea about the culture and this whole big, massive, massive thing. And you talk about having to integrate that culture into UK culture.
Mm.
Can you even just lay out, like, on a really fundamental basis? I know this is like an impossible question, but like, when you talk about the Toyota culture, what are you talking about?
Oh, well, I'll give a few things on that. First of all, when I started, we were there for a week's induction in Derby. They then shipped us straight to Japan. After 5 days, they shipped us out to Japan, and I was in Japan. I think it was for 3 weeks. So, and this was in 1991.
Unreal.
And they showed us everything, you know, how they build the car, all the practices and everything. So we all came back. And the thing was, I'll say again, they didn't expect us for 1 minute to take what they do in Japan and put it in the UK. They were very, very clever in terms of how we take their practices and adapt them to the UK way of working. So with the Toyota culture, everyone knows about the Toyota production system. There are thousands of books about the Toyota production system, lean operations to do with continuous improvement, Kaizen, all of those type of things, just in time. Everyone knows about that. The other side of the Toyota culture is more deep-rooted philosophy, business philosophy based on people and human motivation.
Mm.
And that's the Toyota way. And that's the bit that a lot of people don't understand because it's the two things together. It's the Toyota production system.
Right, which is like the technical, the process.
And the Toyota way, which is all like the people side.
The culture.
People side.
Yeah.
It's those two things together, which you could call the double helix of the Toyota DNA in some respects.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And together make Toyota the successful company that it is today. So it's those two things they get. And to study the Tuatha Dé, that's what throws people's minds completely, I think. And try and find a book in the Tuatha Dé. I only know one good book. It's a fella called Jeff Leiker. He's a professor in Michigan University.
Mm-hmm.
He's wrote a book called The Tuatha Dé. It's fantastic. And he comes and he works with us quite a lot. He brings people to our factory to work with us. But it's those two things together which make Tuatha the great factory.
Yeah, and for any business owner listening, I'd highly recommend checking out The Tuatha Dé. Also give a quick plug to Ryan Tierney, who mentioned earlier, Lean Made Simple podcast. It's recorded in this room. If any of what we're about to talk about the rest of this interview, like, grabs you as an entrepreneur, Ryan has produced these amazing, there must be at least 20 or 30 episodes now that break it all down really, really practically for SMEs and small businesses.
So a bit more on the Tuatha Dé. Let me explain a little bit more.
Which is how I met Alan, by the way.
Yes, let me explain more.
He came on Lean Made Simple. Go ahead.
I think it's important to explain what is the Tuatha Dé. There's two key pillars to the Tuatha Dé.
Yeah.
Continuous improvement and respect for people. They're the two key pillars. Breaking down continuous improvement, you've got challenge. Anyway, challenge everything you do. Always looking, you know, there's always the challenge, what's going on. Kaizen, doing things better, you know, making change, making things better. And Genchi Gen Boots.
Hey!
You know about that
my
one.
My favourite.
You know, yeah. So Genchi Gen Boots basically means go to the source, understand the facts. But actually, if you want to know the literal meaning of Genchi Gen Boots, so if you break it down into the Japanese, Genchi means the real place, mm-hmm. the actual real place. Genbutsu means the real thing, the actual real thing. So when you think of it like that, you know, if you want to go and see something, you want to understand something, go to the real place.
Mm.
See the real thing.
Wow.
Don't look at a document. Don't look at a PowerPoint presentation. Go to the real place, see the real thing, and truly understand. So that's one side of the Tuatha Dé.
Yeah, and just park there for 1 second, yes. Right? Because this is massive, right?
Yes.
So how many people work in your factory?
2,700.
Right. Okay. And when we went over to visit you guys at that time, there was a car coming off the line every 88 seconds.
86 now.
86 now.
It's fed up a little bit.
Right. So just wherever you're listening to this episode, right, if you're driving, pause that for a second and just let that sit in, okay? Sink in. 2,700 people. There's a car coming off the line every 88 seconds. And my big takeaway from spending time with Alan over at Tuatha Dé with Lean Made Simple, you know, this guy, incredibly, incredibly senior position, and he practices that Genchi Gen Boots, which is he goes to the source and understands the facts. So he's on the shop floor. He has meetings on the shop floor. He goes there all the time instead of being crammed away up in an office somewhere, instead of being stuck behind a big mahogany desk. He's there seeing exactly what's happening, the real place, the real thing. And how many business owners, myself included, we have a team of three, can so easily detach myself from the operations of the business. And I don't know, I'm over here, I need to do sales calls, I need to do this, I need to do that. The Tuatha culture is unbelievable because like, no. Everyone needs to be in the real place, looking at the real thing all the time. Why?
Why? Because that's where you get the respect from. Well, one, you get respect from people.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, you really understand what's going on so that you can help, coach, develop people
mm-hmm.
to solve the problems. And number one, respect the person on the shop floor.
Mm.
That's what it's all about. The person, the only person that adds value in our company is the person, the team member who's putting parts on the vehicle.
Right.
Everybody else is there to support that person. That's the difference. So that's where you should spend your time, where you're actually adding value to the shop floor or to the product.
Yeah.
So my day will be first 2 hours blanked out, shop floor time. May not always be on the shop floor. Maybe other things come up that I have to do, but it's blanked out on the shop floor. And I'll go and maybe look at problems from the previous night shift, or I want to follow up on a previous major breakdown on a piece of equipment, something like that. I may follow up on a quality defect. First 2 hours on the shop floor. We then have what we call a Japanese word, asakai meeting, basically morning communication meeting. The whole company gathers, all the senior people in the company, and they understand. We're quick. It's only 15 minutes going through any safety issues, labor issues, quality issues, production issues, close, 15 minutes. Everybody in the company very quickly understands what's going on. Then we move on to what we call a daily quality meeting, which we would have in the body shop, then the weld, then the press shop, paint shop, assembly shop, wherever. We will move around looking at previous defects or what is their strategy to improve quality going forward. Mm. And then after that, I would probably have divisional reviews, again, with each of the departments that report to me, but that would be on the shop floor. And that could be strategic items, you know, things that they're working on throughout the year. It could be reviewing a major breakdown. It could be they're after capital expenditure, so they want to show me. But I want to see that on the shop floor, by the machine, by the thing that they want to do or the thing that they're explaining. That brings me up to lunchtime. So by lunchtime, I've done my 10,000 steps. That's it.
That's unbelievable.
Afternoons, I would say, are more strategic or more, you know, with HR or planning or labor or, you know, that type of things, but a little bit less. So that's the importance I attach to it.
That's great. Hindsight's obviously like 2020. Like, you learn a lot about your life looking backwards. You said earlier that it was working on the chassis line with the 44 workers and you were the foreman is where you learned leadership.
Yeah.
Knowing what you know now, what were you learning and what were you experiencing and how did that set you up? Because you were pretty young guy from Belfast.
I was 25 years old when I was put in charge of the chassis line.
And the guys, I'm sure there would have been guys in their 40s or 50s.
Oh, 40s and 50s. Most of them had been there for years and years.
And people may have had a certain opinion on someone from island of Ireland.
Of course, this young graduate, you know, thinks he knows it all, coming in and working on. No, but that taught me a lot. I can't say it was my most successful ever job.
Sure.
I can honestly say that.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I learned about leadership was incredible.
What did you learn?
In terms of respecting people.
Okay.
Communicating with people, setting direction, but really working with the girl or the guy on the shop floor and understanding what they do, what difficulties they have, and how I can support them in developing them. Because going back, they're the only people who add value or create value in making a vehicle.
Yeah. Why do you think you're so drawn to the shop floor? You know, like, it feels like I'm not saying this, but even if there was somehow this opportunity to go over here and do this, I would feel like you're like a magnet just being pulled back there.
I'm not really sure what it was, because my first 10 years at Toyota were probably in more office-based functions, actually, in production control and logistics and planning and that type of thing. But my big breakthrough came when they asked me to go to be the production manager of the plastic shop. Now, the plastic shop, it's a great little shop because it's sort of one little entity. They make bumpers and they paint bumpers. They make instrument panels like dashboards and a few other plastic parts. So it's a little business unit on its own.
Mm-hmm.
But you had control of your own destiny. Everything from the quality result to the cost result, everything, it was in your destiny. Mm-hmm. And that was when I really, this is for me. This is because it was one little business unit, you're on the shop for every day.
Working
on those problems, helping people solve their problems. That just got me hooked.
Got the bug.
Yeah.
And going to Japan in 91, like, is that the furthest you'd traveled at that stage?
Oh, easily, yeah.
And like,
first time long haul, I'm sure. Yeah. It must have been,
What was that like?
Oh, it was amazing.
Stepping off the plane.
It was absolutely amazing. Because, okay, Tokyo's a crazy city and, you know, they're used to Westerners. But where we were in a place called Toyota City. Actually, because there's several assembly plants all around the city. But even that, where we stayed was out a bit more rural Japan. So it was rural. So we even school kids, you know, seeing these Westerners walking down, you know, they'd all be looking at the Westerners walking down the street. It was very, very different. And at nighttime, we'd go into, the big city was called Nagoya. We'd go into Nagoya at nighttime. Great, you know, really a good city for nightlife. But back in 91, everything was in kanji characters, Japanese characters. So to get home at night, you had to remember the kanji characters to get you back to Toyota City.
And you had no iPhone to take a picture of.
No. I still remember them. The kanji characters for Toyota City is a squash frog with a suitcase on its head, square window, tap. But try remembering after a few pints, you know?
Oh, my goodness.
You know what I mean? You had to. It was the only way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was a very, very different place. But you met some lovely, polite people. Mm. They're the nicest people you could meet. Yeah. Very, very, you know, very orderly, very, you know, everything. They'd queue in a line. We'd get the bullet train, the Shinkansen. And yet the first time you get it, you see them all queuing up on this little line in the station. You say, what are they all doing? You know, we're used to a big mass of people, you know, getting on the train. But the train would come bang on time and the doors would stop exactly where the queue is and went in. You know, things like that. It just blew your mind.
Phenomenal.
It was crazy. Crazy place, but I love it.
Japan is a very interesting place. And, you know, Japan's obviously been on this massive journey of, I'm going to say, rebirthing itself, really, post-war.
Yeah.
And they seem to have created this unbelievable culture. Not just, we're talking about Toyota as a company culture, but the culture of a nation. Like, what's going on there? And why do you think it's working?
They're a very regimented nation. They're very good at sticking to rules and standards, which is, you know, going back to Toyota, that's why we're very successful at building quality cars, because standardized work is one of the fundamental things in a car factory for building vehicles safely, but to good quality and to good efficiency. So standardization and regimented, I think it's one of the things that I'd pick up from that.
Yeah. And if you compare, now I understand there's certain ways we'll have to talk about this, but if you compare Toyota to like other car manufacturers in the game, like what is different in terms of output or culture or how you do things or the number of people that it takes to do things? Sir, anything you can speak?
So I've worked for three car companies now, and I would say it's less hierarchical. You know, in terms of senior people working directly with shop floor members, it's it's there more than in other car companies. Respect for the team member on the line is a lot more than other car companies. And the drive for continuous improvement and Kaizen is just relentless. We just don't stop. Once you've done one Kaizen, you're on to the next one. It's just continuously, there's always a better way of doing things. And that's bred into everyone in the company. Continuous Kaizen. No one's ever going to lose their job over it.
Mm.
And everybody knows that. No one's ever, not one person has lost their job at Toyota UK because of doing Kaizen. And the other thing that I think we do quite well is we listen to the members and hear their voice. We have a thing we say called voice of the member. We want to hear what they've got to say. You build a car all day, every day.
Mm-hmm.
What's your improvement points in making the car? We will ask them that. We do things like quality control circles where we get teams together to work on a problem. But for us, it's listen to what they've got to say, but also developing them as production members as they go through it.
Unbelievable. Yeah, that's a very good point. Like if someone's making however many dashboards to make in a month or a year or whatever.
Yeah, we've got 2,700 people in the factory. Every one of them has got a good brain.
Yeah.
Let's use every single brain, not just treat them as people who are going to come and assemble cars all day. Let's use their brains. Let them tell us the better way of doing things.
Yeah.
Not top down from management. We want to hear it from the bottom up.
And that lack of hierarchy, or maybe another way to think about it, is like access to senior leaders.
Yeah.
Like you do like a lunch or something, don't you?
I do a thing called...
and your office and your desk is just hilarious.
Oh, get away.
Your desk is so funny, man.
So what we do a thing called lunch, but I'll probably do one a week. And we'll provide lunch for a group. It'll be one group. Maybe you're talking 20, 24, 25 people. And you go into the group and there'll be some pre-prepared questions. And the group leader will, in the week before, ask them, what questions do you want to ask senior management? There's a few, you know some of them. So you'll go through those questions, but then it's a free-for-all. They can ask whatever they want.
Love that.
And I think it's absolutely, I love it actually, because, you know, I'm deputy managing director, but also I sit on the works council. So I work directly with the union. you know, we know what's going on. As best as possible, we will tell them what's going on in the company. They will ask about what's the next model that's going to be built at the factory. Sometimes it's difficult to answer such questions, but we will tell them what's going on. They will ask you, what's going on with the car park? We've got problems, you know, with the hedges, you know, it could be anything. But again, hearing it directly from the team member's voice is what we want.
Mm.
And I think they appreciate as well, you know, for the deputy managing director to come down, spend time with them, listen to them, answer the questions. I think it goes a long way.
Unreal. Well, this is one of our little Kaizens, as you would call it, one of our little improvements. I don't know if you can see it from where you're sitting. On that bookshelf there, there's a wee green light.
Yeah.
And anytime Daniel wants to jump in or has something to say, the wee green light goes on. So I know when to pass the mic over to him.
Jump in, Daniel.
So I have a quick question. So of course with Toyota and all that, every 86 seconds are you saying, like, you've got a new car coming off the line and all that. How does stop and fix get incorporated into the
whole
line?
Stop and fix?
Stop and fix, yeah.
Superb question.
He's asking.
Really
he's asking because he just edited the stop and fix Lean Made Simple episode this morning.
Well, anyway, you're under pressure, number one, to build quality cars, but also keep the line running, because we want to run that line at like a 96% operation rate. Only 4% of the day that line can stop fixing problems. But it's all about built-in quality. That's what you got to strive for, built-in quality. Not stopping the line to fix the problems, or not letting the cars get off the end of the line and fixing them afterwards. You got to build in the quality. And that's the hard bit. It really is hard, because you got to fix the problems at the source. Mm. But it's one thing that we relentlessly do day in, day out, is try and fix the real root cause of the problem. Sometimes you can put a stick and plaster over a problem, but it'll come back again.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're potentially going to have to stop the line again to fix the problem. You got to get to the real source of the problem. And sometimes that's very, very difficult. You take a minor defect, like a scratch. You get a scratch on a panel that's been caused, a painted panel that's been caused through the build process. Where did that scratch come from?
Mm.
Then you get a repeat of that scratch. Where did that come from? So first of all, define the point of cause on an assembly line with there's probably about 180 cars in the assembly shop. First of all, finding it. That's difficult, number one. So we have a series of cameras and other devices that we can use to narrow down. You find the point of cause, but then finding the root cause. Why has that scratch been found? It could be something with a bit of tooling that's caused the scratch. It could be your belt buckle. It could be your ring. It could be anything.
Yeah.
Find the root cause. Eliminate the root cause. Move on to the next problem.
Yeah. You've got a thing called direct run. Is that what you
direct
call it?
Run. Direct
that's,
run.
That's class. And again, it's like trying to translate this stuff to the business owner listening. Because direct run, like even for us, Daniel, or even what Alan was talking there about built-in quality. Like, we have quality control checks for podcast episodes and things like that. But what Alan's saying is, make it so that stuff isn't even coming up in the quality check. Do you know what I mean? Because you're making the podcasts good. You're making the editing process so good that actually you're not finding mistakes, because you're just building the high quality into it while you're doing it.
So we focus on direct run. Direct run means it's the percentage of cars that come off the end of the line that can go straight out to the distribution yard and onto the customer. That's our focus, that no car comes off for a repair. Again, some of these repairs, some are really small, quick polish on a scratch. Some of them could be a little bit more major. But the only way to improve your direct run ratio is built-in quality.
Mm.
Of course, you can stop cars by stopping and fixing. That's one way of doing it. That'll improve your direct run, but you can't. That'll stop the line eventually,
mm-hmm.
and your efficiency will drop. You got to get to the root cause of the problem.
Right.
And that's the relentless activity you have to go through. It takes a long time. We can get up to 95%, 96% direct run at the moment. That's probably our capability at the moment. We benchmark the best plants into the global world. They're hitting 98%, 99%. There's always more room for improvement. That's what we strive for through good benchmarking. How do they do it? We'll go out and do a visit, and how do they do it? But that's the Toyota world for you. We're always benchmarking against each other,
mm-hmm.
and we set the bar high.
Yeah, it is interesting. Like, I remember, like, Paul Blage even, like, he was saying, we were looking at various aspects of your guys' production line.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, the guys in Turkey, they do it this way. And we went over to them and then we came back and we thought, do you know what? We're going to have to try and do it a better way. And I'm like, I love that. So there's a lovely spirit of collaboration and there's also that little sprinkle of competitiveness.
So there is now 4 assembly plants in Europe, Turkey, Czech Republic, UK, France. I said Turkey, yeah, 4 assembly plants. And we compete for business. We compete for the next model. That's fact. So if you're competing for the next model, why would you collaborate together? Why would you share ideas? You know, but that's what we do. That's what we do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, almost every week, somebody's going out to visit another plant. How do you do that? That's the Toyota teamwork. They will openly share with us, you know, what they're doing. Same with us. We invite them all the time. They'll come and... So I spent a lot of time in every one of those plants, understand how they do it. And every one of us have got our strengths, not so good points, but we will share. And if I've got a problem or one of the engineers have got a problem with a specific, and we're scratching our heads how to solve it, just pick up the phone. Pick up the phone and they'll tell us what they're doing. Not just in Europe, North America, Japan, wherever. We can pick up the phone through this. We call it shop by shop network. It could be a really technical issue, could be a, you know, human resources issue, anything. We've got that network.
Yeah.
And that's where Toyota's, and again, another one of Toyota's strengths, I think, that global network of companies, it's very, very strong.
Mm. Yeah, it is. It is the epitome of like a rising tide lifts all ships.
Yeah.
Ships. That's what it feels like anyway. You guys make Corollas?
Corolla hatchback and Corolla estate.
And what do you drive?
My wife drives a Corolla. My daughter drives a Corolla. I drive a Lexus. Yeah.
So again, it's only through meeting Ryan Tierney and reading Toyota Way and all sort of stuff. I had no idea that Lexus is part of the Toyota brand as such.
It is. Lexus is the premium brand.
I had no idea.
But they're built in Toyota factories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I didn't know. I really didn't know.
Yeah.
And the success story of that brand too is just unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, incredible. You think, you know, over, when did Lexus come on? You know, 20 years ago, it was just just starting to get a bit of market share. But now it's top premium brand, Lexus,
yeah.
You know, it's really taken on some of the big German premium brands, you know.
Oh, 100%. You know, and my wife's from Bavaria, so I know, I know all too well about that. You also, you don't just drive, you know, Toyotas and Lexuses, you also drive a motorhome.
I do indeed, yes.
Talk to me about your motorhome. Actually, just before we kind of go into there and start kind of wrapping up, why is it so important to you that whenever you leave the factory, which is this unbelievable culture of its own, like when I was there, I felt like I was like part of a town.
It is a bit, yeah.
It's like huge.
It's huge, yeah. It's a 600-acre site. Yeah.
And the time in there, time works differently in that place, because we were in there shooting, you know, a few YouTube videos. I looked down at my watch and I was like, have we been in here for like 7 hours? If you had asked me, I would be like, yeah, maybe like 90 minutes.
Yeah.
So why is it so important to you that whenever you not just leave the factory, but kind of cross into your home or your personal life, that you make that transition very, very clearly?
I do, actually.
Yeah, which really surprised me, because a lot of kind of the stereotypical idea of like a top executive or whatever is a, you know, just like that 150-hour week sort of mentality.
No, I do. I do find I can switch off.
Yeah.
When I have that 20-minute, it's only 20-minute drive home for me.
Yeah.
But I can switch off on that 20-minute drive. The factory's still running. I can still get calls at night.
Uh-huh.
A big machine breakdown or so. I can still get, but that's not so often, I have to say. But no, I do switch off. Mm-hmm. I've got plenty of outdoor. I've got plenty of hobbies and plenty of things I do to switch off. I think it's really important that you come home and you gotta make time to relax. It's really important.
So what are some of your ways that you do that?
Some ways. I sing in a choir.
Unreal.
I've been singing in a choir for in Ashbourne. I live in a village near called Ashbourne, and two different choirs over the years. It's great. You meet so many different people. So many great experiences. The challenge of reading music. No, when I say I can read music, but the read music and then sing. I'm not one of the best singers in the world, I have to say. You know, I'm in the back row type of thing. But But that challenge to read some really complex pieces that I would not normally listen to myself, like mm-hmm. Mozart's Requiem. Mm-hmm. I would listen to that. But to sing it, to be able to read the music and say, that's a challenge. And you completely switch off from the Toyota world. You don't even have time for that to come into your mind. No, I really enjoy
it. It's such an underrated thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, because it's that even that like group collective feeling.
Yeah.
It's very powerful.
And people from all walks of life, from farmers to shopkeepers to psychotherapists, you know, they're all in. I have some great friends.
Yeah.
You know, through that.
And your motorhome?
We've had a motorhome for 3 years. We had a caravan when the kids were younger.
Yeah.
And when they got the teenagers, you know, they didn't want to do that anymore. So we got a motorhome 3 years. Oh, we've been everywhere. We've been to Europe. We've been to Spain, round Ireland. You know, we've been everywhere. We love it. Go with the dogs. You know, we've got two dogs and it's just get away.
Yeah.
Get away into the countryside. We like this wild camping thing. You just rack up on a field somewhere and just, you know, off you go. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Love it.
Super. So, I mean, I love your story so much for like so many different reasons, but I love, you know, I love the Belfast origin story. I love how you've been able to go off and have this incredible career. You obviously, your career spanned through lots of different seasons of Northern Ireland's culture and the Troubles and all sorts of stuff. How is your own, got to say, like, view on home changed over the years?
I still have strong connections with Belfast. I've you know, my mom and dad, when they were here, I still, you know, visited quite a bit. My dad's still here, try and visit him as much as possible. I've still got a great group of friends in Belfast. We'll be out with them tonight. And from all sides of the community as well, I have to say, you know, great bunch of friends. I would call myself and a Belfast ambassador as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I meet so many people in work and you talk to them about what they're doing and I always throw in there, have you ever been to Belfast? And they say, no, I've been to Dublin. I said, no, you don't want to go to Dublin. You want to go to Belfast. You want to go to Belfast. But the amount of people that are now coming to Belfast, it's huge compared to what I had recognized from a few years ago.
Sure,
I'll tell them where to go and you got to go to this place, do that, go to this restaurant, go to this pub. You know, I've still really strong connections from around here. Yeah,
that's great. Well, at the end of this interview, I'll get on the phone with the NI Tourist Board and we'll maybe work out a wee bit of a commission here. You know what I mean? It's like every person you send in Northern Ireland.
No, it's every week I'm talking to someone about coming to Belfast. Yeah, every week.
That's class. And when you come back home, because I know you're back and forward a good bit. Like, what are some things that you love doing that you feel like you can only do here? Like, is there a place? Is there something you eat? Is it, you know?
We always end up going out for something to eat, something to go somewhere to visit, go and see my dad. There's so many nice places we go. But you know one thing I love to do?
Like?
Walking up the Cave Hill.
Oh, man.
Napoleon's Nose.
So good.
That, you know, there's wonderful place in Northern Ireland, but it's just amazing. To walk up there, get your boots on, walk to the top, and, you know, on a nice day,
yeah,
you're looking all over Belfast. That pulls your heartstrings. It's absolutely brilliant.
The view is insane.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah.
You talk about wild camping. Like, this is probably, I don't know, if I don't think I can get in trouble for saying this. We used to go. Notice the use of language there. Used to go.
Yeah. Kids, yeah.
Yeah. Wild camping up Cave Hill. And you would just open the tent in the morning.
We've done that, yeah.
And the sun coming up. And you're just like, mate, what is this city? Yeah, yeah. You know? Like, if it was super warm, you'd be like, is this Cape Town or something? Yeah. It's just, like, it's an unbelievable
place.
Well,
when I grew up, the Cave Hill was my playground because we lived just on the edge of the Cave Hill. So we were up there. That's what it was. So now to go back, you know, all these years later and for a walk up from the castle up, oh, it's fantastic. I love it.
Smash. Love it. Unreal. If you could, this is us properly landing a plane now, if you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for, like, a cup of coffee or pint or wine or whatever it is, who would you take them? Where would you take them?
Oh, there's too many people, too many sporting people, music people, love them all. But anyway, there's one who, somebody who's really inspiring me at the moment, that's Fergal Sharkey, the Undertones.
Mm.
He is inspiring. I'll tell you why he's inspiring me. I do a lot of open water swimming as well. Another one of my pursuits. What that guy is doing with the water companies in England, he's a fisherman, not a swimmer. What he's doing with the water companies, holding them the account with the government, he's absolutely inspirational, that guy. I'd love to have a chat with him and see where does he get this energy from.
Yeah,
in terms of you know, doing what he's doing, incredible. I'd love a chat with him. I like his music as well.
I was
going
to say, I think you'd get on pretty well with him.
I love him as well. Yeah,
that's class. Yes, boss.
And where to take him?
Yeah,
where we generally end up in an early evening when we come over for the weekend, we go into the John Hewitt. Why I like the John Hewitt? It's I like the craft beers. They do a cracking selection of craft beers.
Yeah, they do.
There's always a bit of music on. The crack's good. Fantastic.
So good, man.
Is it okay if we do the time machine question as well?
Like,
do
you think that's time machine?
Oh, you're not ready for this one, man. You're not ready for this one. Yeah, Daniel, why don't you close the interview, man? Go ahead.
Awesome. I'll do that. So, Alan, if you could go back in a time machine to an 18-year-old version of yourself, what would you say?
An 18-year-old version of myself, what would I say? I would say, spread your wings and travel, number one. Get out of your home environment, because the only way you'll really discover yourself is to get out of your comfort zone. That's number one, travel. Number two, I would say, set yourself ambitious goals. That's one thing I didn't do. Did I ever think I'd become deputy managing director of Toyota? Not in a million years. Set yourself ambitious goals. Believe anything's possible. And number three, why did I say three?
I knew you went for three. You just committed. You're like, you know what? I know the rule of threes.
Here's one for the young people. In this age of digital, this digital world, which is, you know, fantastic and, you know, there's so many things going on. Don't forget the human touch. Digital world. Obviously, that's the future with all the everything, but don't forget the human touch. Make the human connections. Have good networks. You know, get on with people. That is so important, as well as being on your phone. That's what I'd say. Three things here. There you go.
Awesome.
Alan, man, absolute slam dunk, genuinely. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate your time.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you.
Amazing stuff. Just want to give one final thanks to NI Connections for making today's episode possible. You can sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com, where you'll get straight to your inbox interesting stories from people who are from this place but are living and working overseas. You'll also get some really interesting insider information about best practices of how to move back home or how to start a business here and all this other really, really interesting stuff. niconnections.com is the place to do that. And we're so, so grateful that we're able to keep this series going thanks to NI Connections support. Have a great rest of your day. And thank you so much for checking out the podcast. Cheers.